This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois poet laureate Kevin Stein has given the state a lot in his time, including a poem to Gold Star mothers, which says they know the honored dead as more than polished stones.
You know the child awash with chocolate, the lanky one whose knees no jeans could hold.
GLT's Judy Valente interviews Kevin Stein as he leaves the office of poet laureate. You'll hear from filmmaker, rapper, and poet Boca Floa about his documentary Nana Dijo, showing at the Normal Theater. It documents racism in North and South American countries. And Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos is in the studio to talk about early retirement offers designed to save money in a tight budget year. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's September 19th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Coming up, a conversation with Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos about a partial solution to address a budget shortfall. The interview is on the way. Governor Bruce Rauner announced last week that Illinois poet laureate Kevin Stein is stepping down from the post after a good long run. Poet laureate is a position that comes with a title, but no job description, no budget, no staff, and no salary. Yet it's been held by some of Illinois' most beloved public figures. Bradley University professor Kevin Stein has held the position since December 2003. He follows in the footsteps of Carl Sandburg, Illinois' first poet laureate, Gwendolyn Brooks, its longest-serving laureate. Stein tells GLT's Judy Valente the legacy of those who preceded him was never far from his thoughts.
Anybody who follows Ms. Brooks, Gwendolyn Brooks, and Carl Sandburg understands it's going to be a daunting task, and one will suffer in comparison to those literary giants and also really active persons in the literary world. So I knew that I wanted to extend some things that Ms. Brooks had done so well, and I also wanted to add my own touches. So we created a couple of poet laureate websites. There hadn't been a website before that. We put a lot of audio and video of poets reading their work on those websites. That's really popular. A lot of youth poems. And they've been a real delight for me. Every place I'd go and work with young folks, I always came back with a pocket full of poems that I thought were really wonderful. The website featured an Illinois poet in both audio and in text, so you could read the poem, and then you could hear the poet read the poem, recite the poem. And I think that's really exciting. Illinois Association of Teachers of English has a yearly grade, middle, and high school poetry competition, and I was able to co-sponsor that and get to write about the winning poems that I found most exceptional. So I was able to write about young folks' poems with the same sort of seriousness and the same kind of passion that I take to writing about the work of James Wright or other contemporary American poets.
That brings me to another question. What are your thoughts on the quality of teaching of poetry in the schools today? Many people will say to me that the way they were taught poetry in the schools just killed it for them. And other people say the way they were taught poetry when they were in grammar school or high school opened up a whole new world for them.
Teachers often are uncomfortable teaching poetry if they were taught by someone who was uncomfortable teaching poetry. We have many wonderful high school and middle school teachers who impart, I think, a love of poetry, but where others don't, those folks err, I think, by making it a Where's Waldo search for meaning. Instead of emphasizing poetry's sonic pleasures, its playfulness, its connecting of people and history across the ages and across demographics, you know, we worry too much about having an expository essay result out of the reading of the poem. And poems are experiences. They are not stories about experience. They are experiences. When you read a poem, you're having an ecstatic experience. You know, I think many times we have folks who spend too much time on rudimentary manners of meaning and not on the bigger stuff that poetry is tied into.
What do you see as the future role of the Poet Laureate in Illinois, and should there even be a Poet Laureate?
Well, it costs the state nothing, I think, you know, interestingly. There's no travel budget, there's no stipend, there's no project budget. So really, it's what one makes of that title. Being Poet Laureate shouldn't be an act of self-aggrandizement. It's a service position, honorific service indeed, but it's a service position. I do think that poetry has a place in the public forum. You know, in ancient Rome, when you published a poem, you actually recited it aloud in public in front of a gathered crowd. So many times in our nation's history and world's history, a poem and the culture became inextricably bound up. So for me, poetry has a public function that I think the Poet Laureate becomes the face of and the agent of.
What were some of the occasions in which you were called upon to write a poem specifically as Illinois Poet Laureate for a specific event?
I was asked to participate in the Gold Star Mother's Ceremony every September. I was touched by Governor Quinn's asking me to participate because he thought poetry had a part in that public forum, in that public ceremony for a very hurtful event. You think about those mothers who have lost a child in service of country. So I did write a poem for that event, directed right to those Gold Star mothers.
Can you read an excerpt of that?
It's only about 20 lines or so, so I can probably do the whole poem.
Okay.
To Illinois Gold Star mothers who lost a child to war, you know these names as more than polished stone, more even than ink on white parchment. You know the child awash with chocolate, the lanky one whose knees no jeans could hold. You know the face you framed upon the wall, those eyes as lush as June lilies, that hair as wild as the river after spring rains. You know the one who shouldered burdens ask of him. You know sacrifice, because she gave you the word whole in act and deed of hour upon lonesome hour. You know these, and shall not forget the way you learned by heart what it means to birth and to give away. Mothers know how mothers greet son's yellow umbrella, unfolding from Kankakee to Cairo, from Watsika to Buffalo Grove to Rock Island, arcing from there to Tokyo and Seoul, Berlin to London, Kabul to Baghdad. You know why sunrise portends sunset, realm of the ask and the given. Your nation's born of more than stone, more than ink on white parchment.
That's so beautiful. What was the reaction, I'm wondering, of the mothers?
It was gratifying that I read the poem, I believe, 6 times or 7 times, and it was gratifying that the poem was well received by the mothers. And movingly, I've had a number of individuals, mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, sisters, say that they have the poem pinned up in their cubicles at work as a way of thinking of their lost loved one. And of course, that just gives one chills as a poet and as a person, as a human being, the way that language can bring comfort and solace.
What made you decide to step down at this point?
You know, it's been a wonderful run. There are a number of terrific Illinois poets, and it was timing. My wife and I are both going to be retiring from our work this December, and so it just seemed a nice fit for me to step away from this and allow somebody else to have this tremendous opportunity.
Any new books in the offing for you?
I am well into a new manuscript. I'm still tinkering, and it's a lot of fun to have something to go and sit at the desk and mess around with and be excited about.
Well, Kevin Stein, thank you for your service to poets and budding poets and emerging poets and to the state of Illinois.
Well, thank you for saying that, and also thank you to the state for having given me this opportunity. It was in many ways a life-changing professional opportunity, and I'm really grateful for the chance.
I've been talking with outgoing Illinois Poet Laureate Kevin Stein. Thanks again.
You bet. Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
Bradley University Professor Kevin Stein will step down in December as Illinois Poet Laureate. He hasn't heard yet from the Rounder administration about the selection process for a new laureate, but he says Illinois has so many excellent poets, he's certain it won't be hard to appoint his successor. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The town of Normal is working to address a budget shortfall for its next fiscal year. One possible solution was approved by council members last night. The community's mayors stopped by GLT most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings, and in the studio to talk about some cost-saving employee buyouts is Town of Normal Mayor Chris Kuss. Chris, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas.
Good to be here.
If the buyouts work as planned, how much would it work against the projected shortfall?
It would go a long way. I don't have the exact number in front of me, but it would, it's one of probably a multiple of things that we're looking at to make sure we have a balanced budget going into the next year.
You don't have the numbers, but a ballpark, knock off half of the $1.2 million projected shortfall?
It likely could if all 18 were to take it, yes.
And we've talked about this before, but talk a little bit about why the town is in this situation. Just remind listeners quickly.
You know, there are two or three things that affected that, and we're seeing state sales taxes. The state share of sales taxes are down locally. The state share of income tax that we get from the state of Illinois is down, and of course we had the loss of the $1.2 million from the Metro Zone agreement being terminated.
Some in the media have described this budget situation with the word crisis. Is it?
Well, that may be a good way to sell newspapers, but it's not a crisis. It's something to be concerned about. We had this happen in 2008, 2009. We had some issues to deal with. The fact that we're proactive on it, we all feel pretty good about it in the sense that we're gonna address the issue. But to call it a crisis is not genuine.
And so what word would you peg it or peg on it or put on it, do you think? How would you characterize it?
I'm not good at synonyms today. it's going to be a tough budget year going forward. It may be tough budget years going forward 3 or 4 years. Well, and a lot of it's dependent on what happens in the workforce and sales tax and utility taxes. There's a whole bevy. And frankly, municipalities all over the United States are going to have to look at their funding models. They relied on sales taxes for so many years as a primary source, and that's proving to be a dwindling source of revenue.
And you touched on what was one of my next questions. This may not be a single-year problem.
Correct.
And so you may be able to stabilize things this year, but next year it's a blank slate, and you're right back at looking at what sort of revenue is coming in the door and what sort of expenses the town has.
Correct.
And so you said 3 to 4 years. What could sort of alleviate that problem? Is it the old cliche of growing the economy?
Well, I think that's a large part of it. We'll have to take a hard look at services as well in the community, but the fact that we can increase the workforce, create new businesses, help businesses that are here grow, would go a long way to alleviate that, not just for us, not just for the municipalities, but for the community as a whole. You know, in 4 years, Rivian could have 500 to 1,000 workers, high-paid workers, and that would certainly help our local economy.
Let's talk about the buyouts for a moment. Who does it affect? What kind of employees?
It runs a gamut. There's not one particular group of employees that are targeted. Primarily people that are close to retirement anyway.
But not high-level managers. They would have to be replaced, correct?
Correct. Yeah. So these are positions that might be absorbed, the workload be absorbed by people currently working for the town. Or if it's a key position, replaced by somebody who's already working for the town. But the idea is to reduce the workforce.
Sure. So because this is a cost savings measure, there are no plans or immediate plans to replace these employees.
Correct.
And if not enough take the buyout, then what? What about layoffs?
Then we'll have to take a look at that. You know, we don't want to do layoffs. We value our employees in the town very highly. And that would be an action of last resort.
And there may be other things coming from staff that might also be cost savings measures that could
avoid that. Everything's on the table for review.
There are a lot of columns here.
Exactly.
Yeah, so.
And, you know, this budget process has been going on for 60 days and will go on until early March. So there's a lot to look at.
Yeah, sure. The fiscal year starts April 1st. Council approves the budget in March. What do you think is going to happen over the next few months?
You know, it's hard. It's just hard to predict. You know, we've made some predictions that are causing us to do things that we're doing now. You know, and that's our I don't want to say best guess, because there's a lot of research that goes into the projections that we make. But that's what we have to go on. And if things could get better, things could get worse. You know, I can't predict the future.
Sure. What's the incentive? What's the carrot at the end of the stick here that would cause employees, Town of Normal employees, to say, yeah, I'm gonna jump on this?
Well, a little bit of money, an extension of health care. The fact that they're getting close to retirement, you know, they could get some health care that they wouldn't normally have gotten in retirement. So we think those are reasonable incentives. And again, it's people that are close to retirement anyway.
Okay. Chris, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Good to be here.
Chris Koos is the Town of Normal mayor. Next week, we'll hear from the city of Bloomington. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. Sound Ideas, I'm Mike McCurdy. Black Lives Matter formed 3 years ago as a reaction to the shooting of Michael Brown by police officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri. Subsequent shootings of especially young black men by police officers has sparked conversations about race probably not heard and seen in decades. But discrimination against black and brown people is not limited to America. Tomorrow night, the Normal Theater is showing the documentary Nana Dijo from filmmaker, rapper, poet Boca Floa. In first-person narratives, the short film documents the struggles experienced by black and brown people in a number of North and South American countries. GLT's John Norton has more.
It used to be so crazy. Back when I was young, I used to feel like I'm embarrassed that my last name is Martinez and I'm this complexion. So it was really crazy for me.
Oakland's a very interesting place. From the moment I lived here, there's always been an undercurrent. This city would be better if we could get rid of black people, and even among some black people, certain types of black people.
Just two English language clips from Nana Diho, the documentary produced by multimedia artist Boca Floja. The 37-minute film splices clips from numerous testimonials on the effects of racism against black and brown people in the United States and Mexico, as well as Central and South America. Now, this woman is sharing the first time she experienced racism. She's saying it happened in junior high when she tried to hang out with the Mexican girls, who said she was too black. When she then tried to hang out with the black girls, they said because she spoke Spanish, she was too Mexican.
Too black for the Mexicans and too Mexicans for the blacks.
Behind a continuous pulsating beat, Nana Diho documents men and women of various ages, ethnicities, and occupations. Boca Floja said he intentionally obscured the occupations of his subjects and also intentionally placed his subjects in settings that often made it difficult to discern the country in which they were filming.
In a way, we were trying to balance the narratives in a way that by placing the occupation in the background of certain people, automatically people will be, the audience will give more credit to certain narratives than others, just because they're apparently more familiar with certain topics. So in a way, we were trying to let the audience in the body of the oppressed in general express itself in ways that were not necessarily attached to geopolitical borders or to, you know, academic backgrounds and so on. So that was one thing. And also in terms of the just the countries in specific, the discussion of Latinidad, I think we wanted to push it further down beyond those constructions that are very, very into national Latino identity and nationalism. So we were just trying to stay away from that and just push the discussion deeper by doing that.
Well, it was interesting that, unless I misunderstood, you also included some people who, how would I say this, didn't exactly have forward-thinking concepts of black and brown people. And some of these people, at least in the U.S., would be the target of stereotypes themselves. As you screen this movie, are you finding that maybe especially Americans are surprised to learn that people in Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Argentina, they all have their own issues with black and brown people?
Yeah, that's definitely, it's been really powerful just to kind of understand the different reactions and the different analyses and the different discussions that come like to the surface in different regions. In the context of the U.S., in general, sometimes we are facing lack of understanding of the black experience beyond the borders of continental U.S. And in the context of Latin America, there's a huge process of denial based on the fact that Latino identity in general is deeply connected to anti-indigeneity and anti-blackness. So, you know, it's coloniality and those oppressive understandings of race and identity express in different forms in different places. But at the end of the day, the documentary is trying to, open up a dialogue in which all those differences can merge and find very similar origins.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton, joined by Boca Floja via Skype from his home in the Bronx. His documentary, Nana Diho, is an exploration of racism felt by black and brown people across North and South America. Can you give me some insight, some context here on, in America, maybe I'm fooling myself, we seem to be thinking that we're finally maybe trying to deal with racism in this country. Are you finding that these other countries in, say, Mexico and Latin America, maybe even South America, are they doing the same thing, or is it a little more subtle than that?
I think one of the main conflicts that I find is the fact that racism could not be understanding racism could not be limited to the borders of discrimination. And we have to understand racism as a structural problem that is deeply connected with systemic structures. So in the case of a specific case of Mexico or some places in Latin America, it's a discussion that happens to be very, very new because it challenges the national constructions of identity. So recently, let's say 10, 15 years, it's been several initiatives that are opening these dialogues and are creating political institutions coming from grassroots movements and autonomous initiatives that in a way are start negotiating with certain at the institutional level, kind of like creating a political force. But it's still very, very new. Just to give you an example, Mexican government didn't recognize the existence on paper of people of African descent born in Mexico until 2001. So it's something that is very, very new and very, very problematic.
Does that mean on government forms that you couldn't check African or Black? Is that what you mean by that?
Exactly. By the census, there was not a space for people to identify as such. So it's slowly shifting, changing. The dialogue is still very new, but it's a work in progress.
Well, that was one of the things I found a little surprising watching this is how government and corporate structures in these countries outside of America have some of the same issues that we have here in America, issues of cultural appropriation, embedded racism, even it was hinted at a liberal paternalistic attitude at times.
Yeah, no, it happens. And the thing is that reality is that the power structure in places like Latin America, it is definitely connected to forms of whiteness. And a lot of people understand, for example, Mexican identity as a racial construction, when in reality it is not. Like, majority of resources and wealth are historically administered and managed by white Mexicans, right? So there's a conflict, a very obvious conflict that no one really feels comfortable discussing or talking about. So it is very similar in that extent.
And that was addressed in the film as well, at least a little bit. The concept of white Latino power structure.
Yeah.
How does, say, white European power structure in the United States and maybe Europe differ at all from a white Latino power structure?
It is a very interesting question because I believe that, at least in the particular case of Latin America, whiteness is more, at least feels more belligerent in a way that there are very few political structures that will constantly challenge it. As in the U.S., there are like historical political organizations that are clearly racialized, and there's a whole movement of Black and brown entities at a political level that are like constantly challenging and organizing, and there's already certain discussions that don't have room in the context of the U.S. And in the case of Latin America, there's open room for being belligerent and being even like with some sort of like monarchic type of attitude in a way, just to put it in that context. So it operates very similar, but it feels slightly different in the context of Latin America.
Okay, all right. Well, you're making a statement, obviously, with this film, not unlike the music you make. After you'd shot all the footage and you're watching and listening to it back, before you produced it, was there things that you captured that surprised you even in some way?
Yeah, no, it's definitely something that happened because first of all, I have to say that I'm a quote-unquote Mexican citizen that is of African and indigenous descent. So in a way, it was very self-referential. All the conversations were revealing parts of my life that historically have been quite difficult to digest. So I was learning about myself, learning about the history of my own community while shooting the documentary, and also assuming the social responsibility of opening up this type of dialogues. So I was constantly listening to things that I was like absolutely shocked, because people in communities in Uruguay going through very similar experiences than myself in Mexico, or like some other people in the United States. So it was quite shocking, and it was like a learning experience through the process that I guess like was very, very organic in terms of the actual production. We had like tons of footage that at the end of the day we couldn't use, because it's the discussion is so large and it's huge. But at the end of the day, we were just trying to produce a documentary that was bringing a narrative that was in a way in opposition to most of the documentaries that I've seen about those topics that were quite focused more on the cultural aspect, but not really discussing the political, historical facts that are very, very important when talking about race.
Absolutely.
GLT's John Norton talking via Skype with filmmaker, rapper, poet Boca Floa. His documentary, Nana Dijo, documents discrimination against black and brown people in various countries and in North and South America. It shows at the Normal Theater tomorrow night at 7 p.m. and is presented by the Illinois State University Department of Sociology and Anthropology. Following the film, Boca Floa will answer questions and perform his spoken word poetry. You're listening to the music from the film, Nana Dijo. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or on your favorite podcast app. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. An early morning fire in Bloomington has claimed the lives of three people, and now we know that a crime has been committed. GLT's Ryan Denham attended a noon news conference and is in the studio. Ryan, thanks. And what did you learn at the news conference?
Sure, Mike. So at this point, what we know is that three people were found dead after a report of a structure fire overnight. Police and fire responded about 3 a.m. This is on Brittany Court, so it's in far northeast Bloomington. To put that in context, it's kind of near Fort Jesse Road. The home is nearest to the intersection of Brittany and Chesapeake Lane. At the press conference today, Police Chief Brendan Hefner from Bloomington said that they believe the fire was intentionally set. Here's Chief Hefner at the press conference.
We feel the fire was intentionally set, but isolated, and there is no reason at this time to believe there are any threats to public safety. Our department is working in partnership with the Bloomington Fire Department and the McLean County Coroner's Office regarding the investigation. No arrests have been made, and circumstances surrounding this incident are under investigation.
So we've all attended these kinds of news conferences. We know when they say there's no further threat, that they might have a suspect in mind.
Yes.
Can we probably make that assumption?
Yes, they're at least aware of all the parties who would be potentially involved.
Any survivors?
Yes, it appears so. I spoke with Bloomington Fire Chief Brian Moore after the press conference, and he said that there was an adult woman who was transported to a hospital with injuries, and he wouldn't say any more than that.
What did the scene look like? What kind of house is this? What's the neighborhood like? Can you set the scene for us?
Sure. It's a kind of a typical two-story house there on the east side. Kind of picture it in your mind. That's probably what it looks like. Very quiet street. So when I was out there this morning, very few neighbors milling around, obviously the middle of a work day. I think most notably, there was no obvious fire damage to the exterior of the home. There weren't like charred windows or a hole in the roof or anything like that. It appears the fire, whatever it was very contained to whatever small area the victims were in. Even in the back of the house, there was no obvious signs of fire damage.
And have they talked about the cause of death for the victims? Was it smoke inhalation?
They haven't yet. Autopsies are being done today.
All right. And so what happens next?
We'll expect probably the names of the victims to be released. Again, this is the adult male, the toddler, and a newborn baby. We probably expect some update on the condition of the surviving victim, this adult woman who we don't know a lot about, or her relationship to the others in the home. And police are being pretty tight-lipped. Here's Chief Hefner talking at the toward the end of the press conference about why they weren't releasing any more information at this point.
We're not going to answer any questions at this time because we do not want to compromise investigation. Thank you. The press conference has concluded.
Well, that's pretty direct.
Yeah, he cut it off pretty good there at the end.
All right, Ryan Denham, thanks for your time. Anything else you want to add about the news conference or anything that happened today with this tragic situation on the east side with this fire?
No, it would have to be one of the more notable homicides in our community if it turns out, as police are kind of going with it at this point.
Especially with a toddler and an 8-day-old infant.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
All right. Tragic situation. Ryan Denham, thanks for stopping by. And GLT News will, of course, keep you updated on this situation as details become more available. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Our very important puzzlers often teach us things.
You can ask me this. Does espresso have more caffeine than regular coffee?
Okay.
Less.
And some facts are more useful than others.
Chambage is a little fizzier than Camel. It's like Camel with a splash of champagne.
Join me, Ophir Eisenberg, for NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia. Ask Me Another, Saturday morning at 10 on GLT, News and Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Get healthy now and stay healthy for the future. That's the goal for a fundraiser that aims to get people moving and helping others. Laura Kennedy has more on the GLT date book.
The McLean County Heart and Stroke Walk is a family-friendly fundraiser for the American Heart Association and American Stroke Association. And it's coming up Sunday, October 1st, from 2 to 4 p.m. at Illinois State University's Hancock Stadium. Bob Miller of Advocate Broman Medical Center is chair of the event, and ISU President Larry Dietz is honorary co-chair. Miller says the Heart Association and Stroke Association have teamed up for this event in order to fight back against a pair of devastating diseases.
These two diseases have such a profound impact on our country. Heart disease is the number one cause of death in America, and stroke is the number five cause of death in America. So it affords a great opportunity for the two organizations to really come together and tackle what would be some very common sorts of themes in what they want to do to prevent these two diseases.
And President Dietz, you're the honorary co-chair. What does that mean for you?
Well, I'm honored to be in this role, particularly serving with Bob. He's a great guy and works a lot in the community, so we see each other fairly regularly. But the issue of heart disease and stroke for me is a personal issue. My father passed with a heart attack, and we've had stroke victims in my family. And so it's both a personal reason and a professional reason. We're absolutely delighted to team up with folks about these kind of causes and to host the walk here. So it's our pleasure.
This is going to be a family-friendly event, I understand.
Absolutely. If you like face painting.
Oh.
And you're an adult, you can do it too. But if we have face painting, we have balloons. We have music provided. In addition to the walk itself, there's a lot happening prior to and post walk events. So it's really an opportunity, very festive sort of environment, and it's a lot of fun for the whole family.
So the walk, is that going to be entirely in Hancock Stadium, or will the beautiful quad here at Illinois State University be involved as well?
Well, it'll feature both. We'll start over at Hancock, and we'll walk underneath the Main Street and end up on the quad. So it's going to be an opportunity for community members to come out. We hope that faculty, staff, and students will participate in the event. I know that we have a number of teams really across the entire community that are participating, but we want to make sure we have a big crowd. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to raise some money that day for a very important cause, and so you don't really even have to register in advance. We hope that you will.
It helps.
Get a better sense of the numbers and so forth. But if you get up that morning and decide, there's a walk going on and want to have some fun and bring some friends out, you can do that just by walking up that day.
How much money do you hope to raise, Bob?
We know we have an ambitious goal for the community of $100,000, and we're well on our way. We certainly need more support from both our corporate sponsors and individuals. We really encourage walk teams, and that's really where it really gets done. So we have folks that can get online and join a team that's existing or create their own team. We average about between 10 and 15 per team.
Oh, that's a big team, yeah.
Currently, at this moment, we have over 50 teams that have already registered. Last year, we had over 600 walkers. And this year, we hope to have 7 to 750. That's sort of our goal.
So the money that you're going to be raising, that $100,000, where does it go? How will it be used?
You may not realize this, and I didn't either, but aside from the federal government, the American Heart Association is the number one source of funding for research as it relates to cardiovascular disease. So they use it for that, for research, but they also use it for interventions that are used in hospitals, such as Advocate Roman Medical Center, where I am, but also for awareness and for prevention and wellness. And this event is really a lot about raising awareness in diet and exercise and healthy lifestyle. And those are the sorts of things we want to promote in this event. Another couple of things is AEDs that we use in the community that have saved many people's lives. Anybody can use an AED and potentially save someone's life. That's another thing that the funding, that the money that we raise will be used towards. CPR training. We do CPR training around the community through the American Heart Association at an astronomical rate. And there are a lot of people with the combination of CPR and AEDs actually do save lives.
That's Bob Miller from Advocate Bromen and Illinois State University President Larry Dietz. The McLean County Heart and Stroke Walk is Sunday, October 1st from 2 to 4 p.m. at ISU's Hancock Stadium. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Organizers advise runners and walkers to take part in a pre-event warm-up and stretch. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Scuttle Button is a recent release from the Peoria-based Brett Button Band. His band plays the 100th anniversary celebration of the Chillicothe Library Saturday afternoon. Button stopped by the GLT studios this week to talk with John Norton about his music and about the music he gravitated to during his teenage years.
I'm Brett Button with the Brett Button Band. We are a blues rock band from Peoria, playing together for about 6 years. We won the International Blues Challenge in 2013.
So you got to go to Memphis?
Yes.
How did that go?
It went well. We played at the Rum Boogie. I believe the top three bands came out of that bar that night. So
that was your competition in the first round?
That was our competition in the first round.
Oh my goodness.
The band that won, Mr. Sip, they were on right after us.
Who else was there? Do you know any other names? Do you remember them?
I don't remember. It was a blur. My son was 5 days old, so I did not want to.
Your wife wasn't too happy about you being down there, was she?
She was all right. She was supportive. It was good.
How did you play when you were down there?
I thought we did well. I broke a string during the set, played it off pretty well.
I've seen Tab Benoit do that. He makes a show out of it where I'm not going to leave the stage till all six strings are all back together again or something like that.
You got to play it off. I didn't play it off so well then, but I've grown into it.
Well, you're a relatively young guy, and you're playing blues, at least blues-based music, whether it's straight blues, like I'll Play the Blues for You. You've got that on your website. You've got some blues rock, more on the vein of maybe Joe Bonamassa, Gary Clark, even Jimi Hendrix. Mm-hmm. Where did you enter blues? How did you get hooked on that?
I was actually probably 6 or 7. My dad was playing a lot of Stevie Ray Vaughan and Eric Clapton, B.B. King, Buddy Guy, and we would listen to GLT, and I would call in to Frank Black every weekend and request Stevie or Buddy Guy or something. I'd always win CDs, too.
I don't remember your name.
Yeah. I'd call in, hey, this is Brett. I want to hear, Frank would know me.
So you donated to the radio station as well?
Yes.
Because you know Frank, he would not, during fund drive time, he would not take your request if you were a donor.
Yep. Yep.
That's so funny. So who do you look at today as some of your peers, some of the people that you really like to riff off of? I mean, you cover, well, let's play this little song. It's your cover of the Gary Clark Jr. song.
Yeah.
Here, let me play this a second here. What do you get out of Gary Clark Jr.?
I love how he incorporates all different genres into what he does. Like, he's a modern-day Stevie or Jimmy in the fact that he's bringing new ideas. He's incorporating hip-hop, rock, basically soul music into blues, and he's just making a new sound. And it's something fresh for younger guys to listen to and maybe get some new ideas from.
Are you incorporating any hip-hop into what you are? You got a new record coming out fairly soon. Yeah. Are you incorporating any hip-hop into what you...
Maybe one or two tracks.
Really?
Yeah.
Can the blues and hip-hop work together?
Yes.
Tell me how.
Just listen to Gary Clark's Bright Lights. That's got a lot of hip-hop orientation with it.
Well, let's give it a quick listen here. Hang on. Let me scoop it up here. Hang on. All right, here we go.
All right, you see how you get your head bobbing to the drums? It's just got that laid-back feel. It's not pushing too hard, but you can just
It's got a groove going here.
It's a heavy groove. That's what I mean by, like, that hip-hop sound, because you just, your head gets going.
So you're not literally talking, like, hip-hop and lyrics and stuff. You're more riffing off of hip-hop.
Right.
I see, okay.
Just kind of stealing the feel, but then still trying to stay true to the blues. Just outside of Moss's West 54.
So what does Stevie Ray Vaughan still do for you? What can you still learn by going back and listening to Stevie today?
It's not all 12-bar blues. When I first started listening to him, I was really stuck on his first album, Texas Flood. Those were 12-bar blues. But then you get into stuff like Wall of Denial or Change It. Those are not 12-bar blues. Those were straight up songs, and he was gonna actually start getting into producing. Go ahead and play Wall of Denial.
Right.
Can you bring that up?
Yeah, hang on a sec. Let me. And what part of the song, or does it even really matter?
The intro.
Okay.
It's extremely hard to play. if you wanna cover it, you got to get that riff right.
So what makes this so hard?
It's what's called a syncopated rhythm. Playing the chords along with it, doing it live, it's difficult.
Brett Bunsen is our guest. He's from Peoria. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. I know you talked about you got a new album coming out maybe in 2 or 3 months, but we're going to stay with what you've got previously. Mm-hmm. And you did a cover of an Albert King song,
yeah.
I'll Play the Blues for You, which has been covered by many different people. And what I'm wondering about is, I mean, you're into Johnny Lang and Jimi Hendrix and a lot of the blues rock guys, but you're also into soul music. Mm-hmm. I mean, Albert was very soulful on his blues side. It sounds like you try to incorporate all these different sounds into what you're doing.
Yeah. I don't know if I've got it quite right yet, but I'm trying. Come on over
to the place where I work. What would be hard about incorporating a more soulful sound into what you're doing? Is it hard to merge that?
It's hard to get the right sound without sounding like you're trying too hard. It's different when I play live than when I'm in a studio setting. I always tend to overplay when I'm in a studio. You gotta lay back a little bit.
You wanna play some of your originals?
Yeah.
What should I play here? What should we play?
This was the first song I ever wrote. This was one of my first recordings.
How old were you when you did it?
I was 24.
Okay.
It's called Peace of Mind. It's a relationship about going sour. It was a time I went through, and I'm glad that is long overdone.
Is it hard for you to pour your heart out into the lyrics of a song?
It has been. Recently, I know this is not good to say, but on the new album, it will be more of my heart and mind incorporated into the lyrics.
Why has it been so hard, and what is paving the way to make it easier to write about your personal?
It's about the vulnerability, because when you write lyrics that really mean something to you, it's like you're putting yourself out there for everyone to see and judge. So it's been hard to write about real feelings. But I need to do that, because my bandmates have told me, you know, that's how you're going to connect with people.
Well, Brett Bunton, great to talk to you. Thanks for stopping by the studios, and we want first dibs on the new album. Okay?
Yes, all right? Definitely.
The Brett Bunton Band plays the 100th anniversary celebration of the Chillicothe Library Saturday afternoon. The birthday bash includes balloon art, a magic show, bouncy house, and card tricks, among other activities. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Our website is also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories today from Judy Valente, John Norton, and Laura Kennedy. Also, thanks to Mayor Chris Koos for his time today, and to Ryan Denham for an update on the fatal arson claiming the lives of 3 Bloomington residents. And thanks to you for listening. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media at 89.1 FM and WGLT.org.